Okay, so welcome everybody. We are going to squeeze in a little bit of sutra study. We've been looking at the Larger Pure Land Sutra, which is a very ancient Buddhist text that is one of the foundations of this particular school of Buddhism, and we're about a third of the way through. So to recap, it begins by Buddha Shakyamuni, who was the historical figure who started Buddhism 2,500 years ago in India, chatting to his friend and closest disciple, Ananda. And he tells Ananda a story. So I'm talking to you, and Shakyamuni was talking to Ananda, and he's telling a story about a bodhisattva called Dharmakara who was talking to Lokeshvara. So it's a bit like
Chinese Whispers.
Yeah, or that film where they keep going inside all the levels of dreams. No.
Inception,
yeah, it's a bit like Inception. So we don't really need to worry about that. What you need to know is that the story that he's telling is set in a sort of mythic time, millions of years ago. It's like a fairy tale or an allegory, or there's no evidence that Dharmakara or Lokeshvara Raja existed. And what Dharmavidya said to me, and it makes sense, is that by telling this story, Shakyamuni Buddha was trying to give across some sense of his own spiritual path and spiritual experience, to try and describe something indescribable through telling this story. So he tells a story about somebody who leaves his home and becomes a monk and meets a teacher. His teacher is called Lokeshvara Raja, and the monk is called Dharmakara. And when he meets his teacher, he has this moment of inspiration. He said, "I would like to become enlightened, just like you, and help all beings everywhere." His teacher is sort of really lit up with the Dharma, and he receives some of that light and is inspired to become a fully enlightened Buddha. And they have a little conversation about that. And then Dharmakara says, "I'm going to become enlightened, and I'm going to make 48 vows to help me in that process." And that's where we've got to tonight. The word that's translated as vow is the Chinese character gan. And vow isn't a perfect English translation. It gives some sense of it, but another equally good word for gan would be prayer. And you can see that actually in English they have two slightly different meanings. A vow is something that we sort of think about willpower. I set my mind to doing something. Whereas a prayer is about asking for inspiration or for help in order to do something. In Buddhism, intention is very important, and that's another aspect of the word vow. It's not a sort of prescriptive rule, but it's you setting a good intention. And the 48 vows are 48 specific intentions that this Buddha set. And the reason I mentioned the other translation of the word prayer is sort of links in with what I was talking about last time, is that there's an appreciation that actually when you're doing good work, when you're being doing dharmic activity, you can't do that if you're being, you can't do it purely if you're wrapped up in wanting to get something back from it, if you're worried about how you look, if you're full of conceit, selfish thoughts, all this kind of self-consciousness and worry about your self-image will prevent you from doing dharmic work. So we can't do it from that place. So the word prayer means that we're going beyond that place and connecting with something that's greater than our ordinary selves in order to fulfill these intentions. There are 48. Some Buddhas have more, some have less. And they're all framed in a particular way. So I'll read the first one. So he says, so he's reciting these in front of his teacher. So they all begin by saying, O Blessed One. So he's speaking to his teacher. And then he says, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, my pure land should include hellish, bestial, tormented or warring realms. Now, if we just ignore the content for a minute, what he's saying is, I'm not going to get enlightened unless this other condition is met. That's how the vows are framed. But you can actually understand them, that they're more interrelated, that actually, as he becomes enlightened, these things will become true. So there is, they're framed in a conditional way. I'm not going to become enlightened unless this condition is met. But actually, the process of becoming enlightened means that naturally these conditions will be met. And the first one of those conditions is that his Pure Land will not include any hell realms, any animal realms, which is where beings are born that are just instinctual rather than sort of acting from a conscious place, any tormented realms or any warring realms. A pure land is a place that a Buddha is. It's a place where a Buddha has influence. And actually, if the Buddha is enlightened, naturally, the closer you are to that Buddha, the more in the sphere of influence of that Buddha you are, the less likely you are to fall into negative mental states. And that's what this vow is describing. When you come into my pure land, he's saying, negative states won't arise in your mind because you'll be so inspired by the presence of the Dharma. And the second vow reiterates this, but using slightly different language. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, beings born into my pure land should be liable to die from there and thereafter be reborn in hellish, bestial, tormented or warring realms. Now, traditionally, of course, if you went back to ancient India, there was the idea that you could be reborn many times into different bodies and different realms across many lifetimes. But there was also the idea that those rebirths happened within this single lifetime. And even in the course of a day, you can think, oh, I felt very inspired. I felt very in touch with something. I felt really compassionate towards that person. And then later on, I felt really down. I felt very angry. And that's like a continual cycle of rebirth that's happening in your mind. And what this vow is saying, when you're in the presence of this particular Buddha, that process won't happen. So it's just a repeat of the first vow again, but in a different language. The third vow is, may I not come to complete awakening if when I have done so, beings born in my land should not all be of one colour, the colour of gold. So we've moved on to a different area. And essentially what's being described is a sort of manifesto for a land where everything is harmonious. And what creates that is the inspiration of this particular Buddha. But you could say what creates it is the same inspiration of all Buddhas, the thing that we can, when we have a sense of the universe accepting us just as we are, when we have a sense of something compassionate reaching out to us, that kind of inspiration that we receive through real physical teachers and also through spiritual experiences that we might have in meditation, that kind of inspiration can create this sort of world. And for beings such as us who aren't very skillful all the time, we might have the inspiration, but also we've also got a lot of ego still. Actually, this is a good guide, and it says, if you're being inspired, then this is quite a good checklist of things to think about. So, do I treat everybody as if they're golden? Do I treat some people as if they're better or worse than other people, or do I treat all people as if they're really valuable? That's what this vow is saying. In the Buddha will treat everybody. Buddhiness in the universe will treat everybody as if they are equally valuable. Not as if they are equally valuable, because that's the reality. Everybody is equally valuable. The colour of gold. An ordinary being, though. Some people would be gold, some would be silver, some would be bronze, some wouldn't be any form of precious metal at all. The fourth vow elaborates on this. May I not come to complete awakening if, when I have done so, there should in my Pure Land be any discrimination or of regard or privilege between humans and devas. So no distinction is made between humans and godly beings, angelic beings, beings from the heavenly realms. Between different kind of individuals on such grounds as colour, relative beauty or other criteria. Save the harmless kind of discrimination that is necessary for naming and keeping count of things. So if you want to know how many women are in the room, fine, you can count and do that, but don't treat people differently based on whether they're a woman or whether they're a man. If you're enlightened, naturally, this is how you treat people anyway. But for those of us that aren't enlightened, we can kind of check ourselves. Are we doing this? Aren't we doing this? The more we're doing this, you can say, the closer you are to these vows, the greater faith or trust you've got in the Buddha, probably. And where your own life is falling short of these, it points to a particular lack of trust in this inspiration. I want to go through these quite quickly. You could take these as a syllabus and do one each week, and then, you know, do some reflection on how well you do that in your own life and how well we do it as a Sangha and so on. But part of the reason we're looking at this is because it's sort of the birth of the Pure Land tradition in some way. So I want to give some sense of the whole text, of what it's like. And what it's like is there's this story about a monk who becomes enlightened, and one thing that happens when he gets enlightened is he produces a realm of influence that has these characteristics. People aren't discriminated against. Everybody is treated as valuable. Nobody falls into the lower realms. The fifth vow says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in my Pure Land, in my realm of influence, people who have a connection with me when they chant my name. I just added that, it doesn't say that in the text. Do not have full recall of previous lives. Now, if you want to, you can understand that we've had many lifetimes in the past, and when you come into the sphere of this Buddha, you can look into your own past and see all the many different births that you've had. But again, you can also see this operating within the scale of one lifetime. If you look at your own life, you can say, oh, well, actually, you might be able to mark out, oh, well, it's almost like I had one life as a child, then I went to university, and that was like a different life there, and then I was different when I had my first job, and so on. And he's not simply saying that you can remember those things, because probably everybody can remember those things, but also that you understand the karmic connections between them, how actions that you performed in the past give rise to ways of feeling and thinking in the present moment. So this Buddha says, as people come under my influence, they'll begin to understand karma. They'll begin to understand that what they did in the past conditions how they are in the present, and all the specific meaning of those things, because each person will have their own patterns and so on that have made them into the person they are today, for better and for worse. So that's like that's a vow about vision, and it's about looking into human nature. How are we as people? How do the different aspects of our lives that we have lead us to being the person that we are today. What's skillful and what's unskillful? All of those things are good things to contemplate. And that's a kind of inward looking. The sixth vow is called the vow of the divine eye, and that's about an outward looking, and it's about looking to other pure lands. And it says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in my pure land should not have the divine eye that enables one to perceive myriad other pure lands. And what that saying essentially is, I am not, Amida is not the only thing that can inspire you, the only thing that can bring you closer to being enlightened, to being compassionate and wise in your own life. There are many sources of inspiration in the faith, not only in Buddhism, but in other religions, in other cultures, even in things that don't call themselves religion. And the more, the less selfish you get, and the more, the closer to enlightenment, the closer you come under the influence of any one Buddha, you begin to appreciate, actually, that you can find this sort of inspiration in lots of places, not just in your own tradition. The seventh vow is called the divine ear, and essentially just repeats that and elaborates on it using different language. O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in my pure land should not have the divine ear that enables one to hear the Dharma simultaneously being taught in a myriad ways by myriads of Buddhas or spiritual teachers, you could say, in myriads of pure lands. And if they should not have the ability to retain and comprehend those great teachings. So not only do you recognize that other people are also good spiritual teachers and have useful teachings and powerful influence and so on, also you can understand what they're teaching. And I guess you could say the reason for that is the more you begin to understand the Dharma, what is true about ultimate reality, other teachers will be pointing at, if it's true, other teachers will also be pointing to those same truths. This is a list of ideals. It's a list that says, if you are completely in touch with Amida all the time, if you are really in the zone as a Buddhist, if your connection with the Buddha is really on top form, and you've done a lot of work looking at your own, here it describes in this past slides, but you could say all the different aspects of yourself and let go of plenty of those, then all of these things should come naturally to you. But you can think of them as a direction to head in. And you can also think of them as describing people and this archetypal mythical Buddha who have already achieved. This is a very good description of what a Buddha does. Let me say some more about that. So on the one hand, when you're relating to this Buddha who's achieved all of these things, you might be inspired, like Dharmakara was inspired, to become enlightened yourself. And you set these intentions and you can measure your progress against these sorts of lists and so on and begin to move in that direction. But this is also describing something fundamental about the nature of the universe. There are these uprisings, pockets of spiritual inspiration, and sometimes they're contained within people, sometimes they're contained within texts, sometimes they just come upon you spontaneously in a meditation. And we relate to those things as ordinary beings, and this list of vows is one way of understanding the nature of those spiritual experiences. It tells us something of their character in a language that we can understand. The eighth vow sort of consolidates the past few altogether. It says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, beings in my pure land should not have the ability to understand the workings of other people's minds, the minds of all the vast multitude of different kinds of people scattered through myriad worlds and circumstances. So not only do the people under the influence of this Buddha, people who are spiritually inspired by Amida, not only when they're really in the zone do they have the ability to understand the workings of their own minds, they can also look at other people and say, well, actually, I have some sense that this is your character and these actions in your past have led to this state of mind arising in your future. And of course, it's this kind of empathy that therapists use. They don't, you know, as an ordinary being, you maybe can't precisely see the character of somebody else's mind and all the conditions that give rise to how they are now. But you have a sense of the general idea, the general shape of their lives. And good spiritual teachers will have that in mind too when they're communicating with you. I remember very famously, somebody was at a lecture by Ajahn Chah, who's a Thai forest monk, I believe. And they said to him, today you've given this teaching, but I've also heard, in the past, I've heard you say the exact opposite. And he said, well, when the student strays too far to the left, you tell them to go right, and when they stray too far to the right, you tell them to go left. Which also points to something about the sort of provisional nature of the words that we use, as well as the sort of skill of a teacher in being able to tune in to somebody's experience and try and say what's helpful. It's more difficult when you've got, when you're speaking to 11 people who are all different. Okay, I'm going to read number 9 and then I'm going to stop because 9 sort of completes the set, and it says, O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, beings in my Pure Land should lack limitless ability to put themselves in other vantage points and perspectives, to instantly stand in any Pure Land and even to travel beyond it. So the 8th vow is about empathy for another individual, and the 9th vow really is about empathy for other spiritual traditions and spiritual teachers. It's saying, actually, can you put yourself in the mind of somebody who practices in a different tradition to you and understand what inspires them and where their spiritual motivation comes from? And not only that, you know, can you do that many, many times for all the different spiritual traditions of the world, and then can you go beyond all of them? And if you can, you should be sitting here doing this teaching.